Thank you for the invitation, and it's been a lot of fun being here. So I'm going to apologize to people who have already seen this talk during the other program that we're running. So I gave a talk, a very similar one, a few weeks ago. So I'm going to tell you about learning quantum state with generative models. And so I'm from the Vector Institute. This is how it looks like. So it's a lot of desks and computers and people. And balloons. So I first would like to acknowledge my collaborators, Leandro Olita, who is here. Well, all of them are here. So Giacomo, Roger, and Andrew Tan, who is my student at U of T. So I guess I'll introduce the ideas in the context of the many-body problem in quantum mechanics. And this is, maybe this audience doesn't need this introduction, but let me just give you this idea that the generic specification of a quantum state requires resources that grow exponentially in the number of degrees of freedom. So for instance, if you want to specify the wave function of a spin 1/2 system with n spins, then this wave function requires 2^n coefficients, 2^n complex coefficients. And so as you know, this grows really fast with the number of spins that you have. This growth is so bad that even with today's best supercomputers, you can solve the, say, Schrodinger equation exactly for as many as 45 spins, which is not too many. And that's all using like a lot of computational resources, like the K computer, for instance. But we're interested in problems that are technologically relevant. And in chemistry, in condensed matter physics, in quantum computing, which are way larger than 45 spins, okay? So what do we do? And so one idea is quantum computers, but we still don't know how to build them reliably, but that's going to eventually happen. But there's still hope for classical algorithms because nature is compassionate because usually the amount of information that we use to describe the systems is smaller than this maximum 2^n capacity, okay? And that's what we exploit when we perform numerical simulations in condensed matter physics. For instance, when we do quantum Monte Carlo simulations, we do kind of like a statistical exploration of this huge state space for certain class of systems where quantum Monte Carlo applies, and we can get correlation functions and study the systems in great detail. The other methods are, say, tensor networks or variational methods, where what we do is to exploit structural information about the state that we're interested in, and such as, for instance, the low entanglement structure of the wave function or a mean field cartoon that we have about a phase and so on. And then we go ahead and we are successful, right? Like in some regimes where these methods apply. And so that's good. I guess what I want to say or what I want to argue is that the machine learning community deals with equally high dimensional problems, okay? And they're very successful at doing what they do. For instance, their problems, like in one of the simplest cases, which is this MNIST datasets of handwritten digits, the input space is 2^28/28, which is, if you want, the smallest they consider. Okay, and they're very successful. They battle the so-called curse of dimensionality with success in a wide spectrum of scientific and technologically relevant areas, such as self-driving cars, natural language processing, and more. Okay, so I guess our thinking was, can we exploit these ideas that they've developed and apply them to some of the problems that we care about in computational condensed matter physics and quantum information and so on. So that's the hope or the idea. And there's a lot of work in this area. So this is a list of a few of the papers that keep coming almost every week. And if you want to be up to date about these papers, you can go and visit this physicsml.github.io that is run by Anna Golubeva. I think she's here, but maybe not. But let me go to to the actual material for the talk, which is learning quantum states and how that relates to quantum state tomography, which I'm going to explain right now. So what is quantum state tomography? So in quantum state tomography, what we do is we try to reconstruct the quantum state of a device by measuring the system many, many times, okay? So, and it is the gold standard for verification and benchmarking of quantum devices, okay? Because it allows us to characterize, for instance, optical signals, diagnose and detect errors in state preparation, for instance, states produced by quantum computers in a reliable way, and it allows us to verify that there is entanglement in a state produced by a quantum device and many more things. So we think this is an important kind of like a thing to do, especially because we're developing more and more interesting quantum devices and quantum states that we would like to be able to certify. So we need to go beyond the standard quantum state tomography because there's a lot of progress in controlling large quantum devices, okay, that go beyond traditional ways of doing quantum state tomography. And that's because there's more or less recent availability of arbitrary measurements performed with high accuracy. And now then the limiting progress in the estimation of the states or in the characterization of the states is this curse of dimensionality, this exponential growth of the description of the quantum states of these devices, right? So here we have an experiment with trapped ions, and that's too many ions. You cannot certify those easily with quantum state tomography. This is Google's BristolCon. It has 72 qubits. That goes beyond what you can do with traditional quantum state tomography. This is D-Way, which has thousands of qubits, and this is an example with cold atoms, okay? And so we'd like to see if we can go beyond this state tomography paradigm for reconstruction. So these devices are growing really fast. So this is examples of papers or relatively recent papers where they run simulation, quantum simulation with 51 qubits, 1,800 qubits, and chemistry, for instance, with trapped ions. So there's many, many things happening in this area, and the systems are getting just like out of control if we want to characterize them correctly. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit more about quantum tomography. So what are the required ingredients? So first we need a quantum system, okay, that we can prepare repeatedly, okay? We need a set of measurements, and then we need a procedure and a model to reconstruct the state. And then finally, we need a certification somehow, something that allows you to say, this device and the reconstruction I made out of it reproduces some state with certain fidelity, okay? So that's the idea. And so a typical state tomography protocol prepares many copies of the quantum system, and then they're measured many, many times. That's your data set, if you want. And finally, you use those measurements to produce an estimate of the state, okay? So that's the kind of like the idea. Traditionally, quantum state tomography requires exponential resources, okay? So for instance, there's a technique called linear inversion that requires inverting a large matrix, and it results in an explicit representation of the density matrix, okay? So you take your experiment, you collect some histograms, and then you invert this relation, the so-called Born rule, which connects quantum theory to experimental apparatus. And the issues are the following. So there's some exponential scaling, both in the representation of the state and the inversion problem, okay? So that's a problem. The second problem is potentially unphysical density matrices, when the statistics of the experiment is limited, okay? So those are two of the issues that we have. But if you want, the most important one is the exponential scaling. If we want to apply this to large systems, there's other one which is solves part of the problems, which is maximum likelihood estimation. It requires an explicit representation of the density matrix, and that representation already scales exponentially with the size of the system. And what they do, or what people do, is they compute this likelihood function of the density matrix, right, and maximize the probability of the observed data, okay? Pretty much like what you do in machine learning when you do maximum likelihood, let's say, for say like some image data set. It has the issue that the exponential scaling is there, and then the some estimation of errors due to finite statistics is difficult and so on. But the issue, the most important one, is the exponential scaling. So how to make this quantum state tomography efficient? There are proposals, right? Like, so one of them is, and this is what I'm going to be doing, is to introduce a parameterization of the quantum state that has good scaling and that has some non-trivial structural information about the quantum systems that you're interested in, okay? And one of them is you can use tensor networks to represent the quantum states. And these are two examples of very interesting papers where they have done that. And one is MPS tomography, where they were able to go and produce estimation of states up to, say, I think up to about maybe 20 spins. And it works really well. And if your state has this matrix product state structure. And then there's one in which they do mixed states and they use MPO matrix product operator techniques, and they're great. But they were mostly in one dimension, okay? So then we came up and we thought, okay, let's also try this. And we introduced the parametrization of the quantum state, which has good scaling, has non-trivial structural information. And so what we used was use this representation, this restricted Boltzmann machine representation for the wave function. And then so we published this paper, it was interesting and so on. Then Giacomo, which was here, also extended this idea and he introduced the latent space purification via neural networks. And so you, if you want, you lift the one of the restrictions that we had in this initial paper, which assumed that we were dealing with pure states, okay? So, so this first paper dealt with pure states with some structure imposed by whatever restricted Boltzmann machine we were using. So that led to good scaling, okay? But there were some assumptions in the parameterization of the state, such as the purity. Then this one is very interesting because you generalized this idea to mixed states, but it has still like a poor scaling. And so we wanted to try to go beyond mixed states with bad scaling to good scaling, okay? Good scaling, meaning that the representation of the state and the number of measurements that you have to produce in your experiment scales polynomially with the size of the system. And we've demonstrated, like, for instance, reconstructions in systems up to, I think, 144 qubits. So we think that that's scalable, even though this is not huge, but at least you go beyond traditional quantum state tomography, okay? So the question is this restricted Boltzmann machine different than the traditional one? And the answer, it is different, right? Like in that we would like to describe quantum states, which are complex value functions of the spin configuration. So yeah, so there's a difference, right? Like we have a layer that parameterizes the, if you want, the real part of the wave function and the phase. Yep. So in this talk, I'm going to introduce kind of like a new parameterization of the quantum state that relies on the parameterizing the measurement statistics of an informationally complete positive operator valued measure. This statistics is given again by the Born rule. Okay, so that's what we're going to parameterize, and we're going to use generative models, which are probabilistic models in machine learning that are used to represent complex distributions over high dimensional spaces. So that's what we're going to be using. We're going to take the experiments, the statistics that we collect out of the experiments, and we're going to parameterize those measures. Like if you want, we're going to generate a model for those distributions that we observed experimentally. And then we're going to use this idea to learn some states from synthetic measurements mimicking experimental data. So we don't have any experimental data so far, that's ongoing work, but So everything I'm going to show you is kind of like numerically generated data, mimicking what you would see in an experiment if you prepare some of these systems, some of these quantum states. And then with that, like, so we will be able to reconstruct mixed states with some structure imposed by whatever neural net or generative model that you use, and it will have good scaling, and we'll show some plots where we demonstrate this is the case, okay? So what is the setting? So we want to, again, we want to know if a large quantum system device works as intended, okay? We think this device can produce some non-trivial quantum states, but we still don't want to use this device. So we want just to certify that the system works in some simple cases. Like, we want to say, for instance, ask this device to produce a matrix product state, okay? For instance, for which we can have a classical description stored in our computer, okay? So, and so this is gonna be only useful in the near term, right? Like, so this won't be useful when quantum computers can produce states that we cannot store, say, in our device. So it's kind of like an intermediate step between what we have, currently have, and when they go bigger, we can still try to produce some simple states that we can still write down in our computer, and then as a way, if you want to, just make sure that everything is working. So that's the setting. So let me tell you about the measurements. So I'm going to use POVM, so positive operator value measures, and so those are characterized by a set of operators MA, where A is like the number of outcomes, if you want, in the experiment. It goes from 1 through M. They're positive semi-definite operators, and they add up to the identity, okay? So let me give you just like the simplest example of a measurement, which is described by a POVM, is the measurement in the computational basis, right? Where like you're measuring either 0 or 1, okay? And this M0 and M1, if you sum them up, you get the identity, okay? And then suppose this is your state in one, just one qubit, right? Like it's some superposition of A times 0 plus B times 1, okay? And now the Born rule, like it provides a link between the quantum theory, which is all this, and the experimental measurement, right? Like, and so you get P0, then you insert like your measurement, like your POVM element in the Born rule, and this is what you get. You get A squared, which you see in every textbook in quantum mechanics. And then if you measure the other one, you get B squared, okay? So that's the simplest POVM you can think of, but we'll use something called informationally complete POVMs, which are, if you want, generalizations of those projective measurements that we're familiar with. And informationally complete may mean different things, or you can phrase this in different things. So one thing, which is I think the most important one for our purposes, is that the measurement statistics, so this Born rule, the outcome of, like the statistics of the measurements, PA, whereas the outcomes of the measurements contains all the information about the state. So that's the most important thing. You can think of this as also for instance, if M, like the number of measurement outcomes in your measure, is of the size of 2 to the n for the qubit case, that M spans the entire Hilbert space, meaning that you can write any operator in the acting on this Hilbert space in terms of this operators M. Okay, that's also informational completeness. The other one that we use is relation between rho and p, the density matrix and your measurement statistics, which is given by this rule or Born rule, can be inverted, okay? So all those are kind of like different aspects about the informational completeness of the measurement that we're going to apply on these systems. So let me give you one quick example for like a construction of a POVM that we use. So we take a single qubit POVM and we make a tensor product of many. And let me give you an example of one qubit Pauli measurement. So one of the most common POVM measurements is this one, in which you basically randomly select which direction to measure in the block sphere, either X, Y, or Z, and then you take a projective measurement, okay? So that's this description of the mathematical description of this measurement that I just described in words, right? Like, So for instance, if you take, I don't know, one third in these probabilities, then you take projective measurements along the different directions, and that gives you six outcomes basically, right? Like, so if you measure along the z direction, you can get either up or down. If you do along the x, you can get up or down again. And if you do along the y direction, you can get the same. And so that's, if you want one of the possible descriptions of this measurement, this one is informationally complete. And then what we do, so that was for one qubit. If you want to do it for a multi-qubit system, we just do tensor products, okay? And that's going to be really crucial for all the manipulations that we're going to do. Okay, so that's my my POVM. It's informationally complete, meaning that if I take enough measurements, I have all the information about the state. And then crucially, this is easy to implement in gate-based quantum computers, okay? So that's my measurement. So now, like the insight that we had was parameterize the statistics of the measurement outcome, and this, and then invert this relation to get an estimate of rho. Basically, inverse, take the inverse of this relation, meaning writing rho in terms of p. And what we do with this statistics is to learn this distribution using unsupervised learning. Okay, create a probabilistic model. For those, we use different techniques. So we can use either variational autoencoders or restricted Boltzmann machine, autoregressive models based on recurrent neural nets, for instance, and more. And here are some cartoons, some pictures that you find online when you Google these words. Okay, and let me just, for a little break, let me tell you what are these models typically used for. Okay, like in machine learning. So they're used to understand probability distributions over high dimensional data, okay? So for instance, images and language and so on. So one of the important use cases of this is language translation, where you construct approximations to the probability distribution of a phrase in, a phrase in English language conditioned on a different language. And this is what, for instance, Google uses for translation, okay? And they do for image generation, which is very popular nowadays. So these are some images of non-humans. So they're basically this person doesn't exist.com. Okay, so if you go there, you'll find you, every time you refresh the website, you'll see a different face of a human that doesn't exist. Okay, so it's pretty interesting. That's using generative adversarial networks, and so you can use them for this type of image generation. You can use those for density estimation, for anomaly or novelty detection. So for instance, if you go on and do a transaction that these algorithms find to have very low probability, then they raise a flag, okay? And then so this has all sorts of applications. And so now one more is like a kind of like reconstruction of quantum states. So let me tell you quickly about graphical notation. So we're going to be using a density matrix, and this is going to be using Penrose representation. So that's my density matrix. The statistics of the measurement is this distribution, this tensor PA. And then the measurement outcomes is a tensor product of small tensors M. Okay, so that's, if you want the physical indices, those in here, and the outcome indices are those. So very quickly, let me show you the math. So this is Born rule. It relates P with the density matrix. And then it's basically the trace of rho times your measurement. And then you take the trace, which are these lines wrapping around the tensors. So as we said, this, if the POVM is informationally complete, then you can invert this relation. And then if you follow this math, what you get is a representation of rho in terms of the probability distribution of the measurement outcome P, okay? And that looks like this. So this is the density matrix and looks like a rho times T inverse, which is also factorable, and then times the measurement outcome tensors. Okay, so that's our, if you want, our answers for the density matrix. And that's probably the most important thing that we're going to be using in the rest. Then As we said, we take this statistics of the measurements, we learn a model, and then we invert. We get this density matrix. I guess I want to emphasize two or three things about this answers for the density matrix. One is that you factorize the state into a probability distribution, which is positive, and it sums up to one times some set of tensors that are factorized. So what I'm saying is that you factorize, if you want, the sign structure, or the, if you want, like the sign structure of the state is given, okay, by some weights given by this probability distribution times some tensors that are well specified. Okay, so it's clear that we factorize, if you want, whatever brings with a sign from whatever is just probability. And the other interesting thing is that since these tensors are factorized, then every non-trivial aspect like entanglement and the complexity of the states comes from this distribution, right? Because the rest is factorized. That's exactly what I'm going to say. So let me show you again the setting. So we have a model for the state. We have the measurements, and now we want to certify the reconstruction that we made out of these measurements. So for those, we need a calculation of the fidelity, either the quantum fidelity or the classical fidelity in the probabilistic space of the measurement. We can measure the Kullback-Leibler divergence in this space, and we can also measure correlation functions. And here, I'll see if I have time to explain to you how we get correlation functions and fidelities more or less efficiently. So this is the quantum fidelity, this is the scale Kullback-Leibler divergence, and this is the so-called classical fidelity, which is given in terms of the model that you are interested in reconstructing and the probability density of the exact state. So this is the setting. So we prepare a desired quantum state repeatedly, perform this set of measurements that are easy to produce in an experiment, reconstruct PA using unsupervised learning, invert formally the relation between rho and P, and perform some sort of certification with these quantities that I introduce. The fidelity, yeah.
Just a clarifying question. So can you just say, so you learn the P of A, where does the P to the minus 1 come from? Do you also have to learn that?
No, so this is given by the measurement. So I didn't go through it in detail, but basically if you take the measurement operators and you do a tensor product, the T matrix is defined as the trace over products over this measurement outcomes. And then that gives you a matrix that I call T of in the POVM space. And then if you take the inverse, because it's factorized, then the inverse is also factorized. And so you basically do it once for one qubit, and then you tensor product the rest. And that's an important simplification, right? Because in general, if you take a different measurement, this inverse is intractable. Sorry, I didn't explain this carefully enough. Okay, so let me show you results. So we considered synthetic data sets from starting with GHZ states. The pure GHZ state is a state where like you have a all spins are 0, 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. So that's this highly non-local state. And its density matrix is given by this object here. But we also simulate noise on top of that state, which we call GHZ with local depolarization or a generalized GHZ state. And this local depolarization is just a model for decoherent of a qubit, where with probability 1 minus p, the qubit remains intact, while with probability p, an error occurs. Okay. And so these are results for just two qubits to just verify that everything is okay. So here are the and the model that we use for this distribution is a restricted Boltzmann machine, okay, for parametrizing this probability distribution PA. And we use multinomial visible units, and we have a measurement with four states per qubit. So we need to kind of like use this RBMs with units which have four values per qubit, okay? And that's what we use here. So as we see, this is training time or epoch, and what we see is that the KL divergence between the distribution of the JIT set, the exact one, and the model that we have goes to zero for all different values of noise, okay? The fidelities, they go quickly to one, as we would expect, both for the classical one and the quantum fidelity. Now, this is only two qubits, which you can do with almost any technique, so we wanted to go beyond that. But when we were faced to this challenge of scaling this thing, we found out that the RBM was not really great, so we changed to a recurrent neural network, which has two advantages. It has the advantage that you can get exact samples out of it, and that the likelihood is tractable. So you can basically compute P of X or P of A. And with that, then we were able to scale up to 40 qubits or 80 qubits with noise and with high fidelity, okay? So that was kind of like a first result. And as I said, we use this important recurrent neural network autoregressive models for the success of the method, because of the tractable likelihood and the exact sampling. Okay, so then we said, okay, can we scale this really to big system sizes? And so we did a numerical investigation of the sample complexity of the learning, okay? And we did that by just basically studying a big bunch of different values of noise for different system sizes up to 80 or 100 qubits, if I remember. And here we show only up to 80. And what we do is we compute the fidelity, the classical fidelity between the model distribution and the exact distribution for the G8 set state, which we can compute for, because the state is so simple, we can compute for big systems. And what we do is to compute that number as function of the number of experimental runs we have to perform. So that's NS. And as we see, as we increase the number of experiments or measurements, these fidelities go to one relatively quickly. And then we measure also the scaling of the number of measurement outcomes N star, at which this curves hit 0.99, okay? Which is basically an arbitrary threshold, but a high one. And if we do that, then we plot that number as a function of the number of qubits, up to 80 qubits, we see that it's fairly linear with the size of the system. And so we did that for both the two different POVMs, and what we found is that the scaling is really favorable, okay? At least from the perspective of this classical fidelity. Then we wanted to go a little bit beyond. Like, these are very simple states. In this case, I'm going to show you also simple states, but that go a little bit beyond this G8 set state. So the first one is the ground states of the transversalizing model in 1D at the critical point, okay? So the transversalizing model at the critical point is given by this Hamiltonian at J over H is 1. And the ground state is critical, and we did runs for like 50 spins. And we're using the same probabilistic model based on this recurrent neural network to parameterize P, okay? And so here's synthetic data correlation functions as function of site in the system from like 0 through 49. And these are the exact correlation function of the state we're trying to reconstruct in orange, and these are my reconstructed state in green. So they match fairly well. And this is for a two-body correlation, sigma one, sigma i, for like this trans correlation, sigma z. And then it matches well with the reconstructed state. Now, so we got a lot of comments about like how this system is just too simple, because basically the sign structure of the wave function you can predict by hand or analytically, right? Like you can gauge this Hamiltonian in a form such that the ground state of the system is always positive. And so we wanted to try to study a system where this is not the case, or at least where we cannot find an easy rotation where the Hamiltonian is stochastic, okay? So then we went and studied the two-dimensional Heisenberg model on the triangular lattice and up to, I think, systems of 8x8 spins, where we can approximate the ground state with matrix product states relatively accurately. And that's what we did here. We simulated this ground states of the system using DMRG, and then we computed measurement statistics of some POVM, and then we tried reconstructing this state again. And this is what we found. So these are correlation functions of the synthetic state. They are antiferromagnetic correlations, typically in this Heisenberg model in the triangular lattice, and they decay fast. And then these are the correlation functions of the reconstructed state, which match fairly well. We also computed the classical fidelities for the systems, and they go up to 0.992 or 0.98 in this case, in the two-dimensional case. And so we're kind of confident that this idea or this approach to reconstruction of the quantum states is reasonable. Finally, maybe I can tell you a little bit about how we compute observables in this setting. So we go to big system sizes, but there are some in principle intractable things that you have to sum up. But luckily, since this big tensor is a probability distribution, then you can sample out of it. So this is, for instance, a trace of expectation value of a local observable here in orange. And then since you can sample out of this distribution, then you can estimate this observable with this estimator, which is pretty efficient, and that's how we get these correlation functions. If you want to compute, for instance, the fidelity with respect to a matrix product state, this is how you do it. So this is basically your density matrix times the state twice, okay? And this you can also try to estimate using sampling from the recurrent neural net. And then you can, each of these tensors is efficient to compute, okay? As long as the bond dimension of the MPS is finite or constant. So that's how we computed the observables. So let me just try to wrap up. So we're applying this to an experimental reconstruction on a quantum computer. We're trying to simulate real-time dynamics using this type of ansatz that we introduced for the density matrix. We're trying to simulate quantum circuits, energy minimization, but there are some challenges, right? Like, so this is, I should mention, which is regularization issues, because in general, we're relying on this initial linear inversion that I was mentioning, and linear inversion had this problem of the positivity of the state that you reconstruct, and that, since we're using linear inversion here, like this T inverse, we're not guaranteed that in general, this density matrix that we get is a physical one, okay? So we have to work on that. And I think we have a poster here. Andrew Tan, my senior, is going to present it. So it's exciting, but it's also a very hard problem because there's no easy way or a scalable way of imposing positivity for these big systems, okay? And with that, let me conclude. So we're starting to explore machine learning perspectives on these many body problems in classical and quantum physics. We have performed an approximate quantum state tomography based on neural networks, which enabled us to study even two-dimensional systems with frustration and so on. And I guess my message is always is I believe there are a lot of opportunities for us physicists at this intersection between machine learning and quantum physics and so on. And with that, I conclude.
Thank you, Juan. Are there questions in the audience?
Sorry, it was close.
So do you know why RNN scaled better than RPM for your generative modeling?
I don't know, really. Like, we couldn't figure out why the RPM was so hard to make it work. So it was literally a practical matter, right? Like, so we started with the RPM because that's what we've been trying, and we thought, well, we can do it and it would scale and so on, but it didn't. It's just much harder to train. And I think the reason was that when you have very multimodal distributions, and some of them are, like for the G8 set, for instance, if you take some of these measurements, you have really high peaks. And so I think one of the reasons is that when you're trying to train these RBMs, you have to sample. And as the modes in the distribution develop, the sampling becomes much harder. Whereas in the RNN, you can always get exact samples. So it doesn't affect this as much. So that's maybe one reason, but I'm not 100% sure.
Other questions?
Since we know some output of quantum circuits are very hard to simulate classically or sharply hard, so there must be some case that RBM or RNN fail to tomography correctly.
Yeah.
Then how can we know that we get the correct result or not?
So there's a signal. Yeah, we won't know, right? Like if so suppose there's a state that you cannot describe classically, such as what, like say, okay, so, okay, there's two things. So if you can describe the state classically, then you can be sure, I mean, you at least know that the problem is either in the experiment or in the reconstruction. But if it works, then you know it is okay. So, but there's no easy way of, like, when you have some of these completely intractable states that you know, I mean, this won't work, right? Like, you need a reference state.
Okay, thank you.
Is it working?
Yeah.
So, when you were showing scaling with respect to number of samples in the GHZ model,
yeah.
So, were you taking samples only in the computational basis? The reason I'm asking this is, so essentially a more general question that I have is, on your formalism, when you learn P of A, there is subscript A, so do you have to introduce a different neural network for each of these bases A to learn this probability distribution? And essentially, yeah, and here, do you kind of need to know that it's a GHZ state? So that to select the measurement basis.
Yeah, no. So the important. So there's many questions. So one of them is so no.
Yeah, the main question is this: if you need to introduce a new neural network for each basis.
No, so so you don't have to measure only in the computational or you, I guess, no. So you measure in the. So what you do is you measure this measurement, this POVM measurement. Okay. Let me see if I find it. So for instance, you have to measure all those six operators, right? So it's not just in the computational basis. And then, so you don't need different models for different bases. You just
when
have
you
one.
When you say you learn P of A is associated with a certain choice of basis, right? So, learn P of A separately or do you include basis rotation somehow?
No, so A is basically the labels of this measurement, okay, of this operator. So for instance, for this case, the Pauli measurement, A can be either 0, 1, plus, minus, right, or left. So it's six outcomes. And so my P has to have six outcomes per qubit. And that's all you need. You don't need different neural networks. You just need one. It's one that learns the distribution over the six outcomes.
And for this GHZ scaling, so do you use only measures in computational basis, or
no? We
do
use
you
measurement.
Use them randomly.
We use this measurement. And this measurement, if you want, like experimental realization, looks like this: you pick a random direction with probability 1/3, So basically either X, Y, or Z. And then you take a projective measurement in that basis. And then you do that for each qubit.
Hey Juan, I probably should have asked this last time I saw the talk. But in your last slide, you have this equation for the reconstruction of rho with the T inverse.
Yeah, like this?
Yeah, so if you actually care about rho, that equation looks exactly like just normal linear inversion with a probability distribution.
That's exactly what it is.
So what could be the advantage of using this generated distribution instead of just the actual measurement distribution you use to train the model?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So the idea is the following, right? Like, so you have this distribution, but when you scale the size of the system to huge, then the counts will be one, basically, and a big bunch of zeros, right? Like so what this thing does, which is the advantage of this thing, is that these models have some sort of generalization that fill the holes in the.
Okay, so it's kind of like some compressed sensing type technique for the data.
Yeah, so and that's where like your inductive bias is important, right? Like you have to impose something that whenever it is filling the holes, is just not doing something crazy. And so we don't have a very good argument for the choices that we made, but it turns out that they look pretty reasonable.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's a pretty good question.
So you have a sparse data set. If you compared the fidelity of the fit with this generative model to fitting using more standard compressed sensing techniques?
We didn't try.
You can't apply those on this.
Yeah, you can apply at least on small systems. Compressed sensing scales exponentially, if I understand correctly. But yeah, you can compare.
Other questions?
Very interesting work.
Thank you.
How might these techniques be transferred over to quantum process tomography?
We're still trying to think about how to do it. So basically, I don't know yet.
What was the question?
I'm sure you explained this in the quantum.
No, the question was about quantum process tomography.
So processes are kind of like a generalization of unitary transformations on density matrices. And so you sometimes like you have a process and you may want to try to characterize what the process is, right? And so it's an important question because that's what quantum computers do, right? Like they do processes on states, but you don't know what the process is in general. And so the question was, how can you generalize this or how do you generalize this? But I don't know yet.
Martin.
So my question is, I'm sure you explained it during the talk, but I must have missed it. So what determines the number of measurements, the number of different operators that you have to do in order to do tomography on the many body state? So for example, for the GHZ state, you showed that these are like six operators. You showed us the set. But when you have a many body system, then I guess this grows.
So basically you can, so long as the measurement that you use is, I guess it was this thing. So long as the measurement is informationally complete, you can, in principle, recover any state if you perform enough repetitions of the experiment. So we for the GHZ, we tried this Pauli POVM with six outcomes per qubit, but we also tried different ones which have only four outcomes per qubit. And that, if you want, makes more kind of like counting sense in that. If you want to reconstruct a density matrix, you need of the order of 2 to 2 to the n elements in the density matrix, right? And that's exactly 4 to the n, which is the number of outcomes that you would have in a POVM with 4 outcomes per qubit. And so this, if you want, the Pauli POVM is overcomplete.
But so you need 4 to the n different types of measurements for a many-body state. On N cubes.
Yes, but that doesn't mean we have to measure the system to the N number of times. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's just that the number of outcomes in your representation is this one.
Yeah. Other questions? Here, Ezra.
I'm sure you mentioned it and I missed it, but in your first model, you had this parameter P for noise, mm-hmm. and it seemed like everything was faster convergent
yeah.
when you have more noise.
That's
Is that
right.
just simply because you can more easily recover noise?
No, so the reason is because when you have noise in a system, as you increase it, your distribution gets flatter and flatter, right? Like, so if you take a noise with probability one, then this state is basically an infinite temperature state.
It's just a trivial.
It's a trivial state. So then, it, like for the learning procedure, this is just way simpler because you don't have to learn anything. You just have to make a constant. Yeah.
Order.
But what is the overall scaling at the end of this, with all the parameters and the number of qubits and so on?
So in here, is
yes.
this, are you referring to this?
Well, so any of these systems which you have done.
So with
through the generative learning, what would you say that the overall scaling is?
I think it's linear, so long as the state that you
linear in what? In the number of?
In the number of qubits.
Of qubits.
I think so long as the state has a simple structure. Okay, so it depends
simple.
On the structure
okay.
of the state,
okay.
but for the systems, the description of the state is really mm-hmm. like tiny. So I think for those, your scaling would be very favorable. But as long as you complicate the state and you start exploring mm-hmm. more like random regions in Hilbert space, I think the scaling is going to dramatically change. Basically at some point become exponential.
Yeah. Okay.
But I don't have a general answer yet.
But we know the system you looked at is linear.
We haven't looked at the no, so only here in the simple system, simple cases.
More questions, comments? Over there.
So here you fix the measurements you're going to use in the beginning, and
yeah.
you just use these. Have you considered combining it with some adaptive method?
So we thought about this, and that's something we want to do. Because these POVMs that we use are clearly not optimal. And so you can imagine like tailoring the measurement to a particular state that you're interested in, such that you bring this scaling factors down. Okay, so what I expect is that these are pretty good scalings, but if you optimize the measurement, that you will bring the not the power law, but the factor in front of it.
More questions? Can you tell us again about the fidelity you get on the frustrated quantum ground state? I didn't get the number, sorry.
I think it's 0.98 for the classical fidelity. So for this one, computing the quantum fidelity is very challenging. So we attempted using this expression or this diagram, right? Like where your MPS snakes on the triangular lattice, and then you can in principle try to estimate this via this Monte Carlo estimate, right? Because that's a pure state, it's simple. You can apply this formula and you get samples, and this is efficient. So in principle, everything is good, but when you compute the variance of this object, it just really blows up fast with the number of qubits. And that's the reason why we couldn't compute it. So it may be arbitrarily low in principle, because the classical fidelity is larger than the quantum one.
But in principle, you can make the assumption that your state is pure and simplify the fidelity, right? You
could yeah, so this is that simplification already.
It's already done,
yeah.
Okay. More questions, or are you ready for lunch?
Yeah.
Maybe it's time for lunch. And let's thank Fang one again.